Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labor MP Andrew Little.
This week, I spoke to Justice Minister Andrew Little about quarantine and testing, cybersecurity, and the proposed sexual violence legislation bill. But first, we talked about the prisoner voting bill, which passed its third reading in Parliament last night amidst a bizarre twist with National supporting a Green Party amendment.
And it was an interesting night last night, wasn't it?
Yeah, a little frustrating, annoying, but I think it is the worst of kind of game playing that we saw with the National Party. I'm not sure the Green Party quite realised what they were doing. They put up a symbolic amendment that they didn't expect to be getting voted up. The National Party voted up by taking everybody by surprise. But it is, you know, it's kind of mucking around with our electoral law. So that was disappointing, but it is what it is, and we'll fix it up next week.
Exactly. What does this mean now when the Second Amendment by the Greens got voted in by the National Party?
The Second Amendment, all it did was take an administrative power that the Electoral Commission currently has to remove names from the roll of people who are disqualified and abolishes that power to remove those names. That's all it does. It doesn't change the substance of the bill, which is to restore the right of prisoners who are sentenced to a term of less than 3 years to vote. So that remains intact and they'll be able to exercise those rights. And even though those who are otherwise disqualified from voting won't have their names removed from the roll as they would currently, it doesn't mean they get the right to vote or retain the right to vote. It is purely, all that happened was the National Party supported an administrative measure that is of little or no significance whatsoever. Their public statements are overblowing what they've done, but it is an inconvenience. We'll get it fixed next week, but it is not significant.
How are you going to fix it next week? Just what's the legislative procedure for that?
You just introduce a bill to amend it and to reinstate the power that was removed last night. We'll just reinstate it next week. Because the third reading passed, we now have to wait till the bill gets its royal assent. It goes to the Governor-General. That'll happen in the next few days. Once that happens, then we can introduce a bill next week to correct what shouldn't have happened last night. And even though the amendment that was put up last night came from the Green Party, they will support the change back because that amendment went hand in hand with the other one that they put up that they also didn't expect to get passed and it didn't get passed. So it's all a little confusing. I know it is kind of politics. I think at this stage of the electoral cycle, when we're 3 months out from the general election, smaller parties are there to distinguish themselves from the bigger parties. They do that through signalling various things, usually amendments to legislation. Nobody expected any of the amendments yesterday to pass. The National Party mysteriously and out of the blue supported one of them. They did it to kind of, you know, muck things up. They think that it's okay to play those sorts of games, particularly with our electoral laws. I think it reflects poorly on them. Anyway, they did what they did. We're in the situation that we're in, and next week we will correct it.
And I kind of want to move to our next topic, which is quarantine. It's gained a lot of attention before the past week, especially now more airlines are now opening their routes back to New Zealand, and that could mean much more pressures being put on our quarantine facilities. Now, we have seen in the past couple of days that some travellers arriving at Auckland have to be diverted to Rotorua or Hamilton, and now there are plans to have to move those in quarantine to Christchurch as well. Could our quarantine facilities cope when we gradually open our, not gradually open our borders, but allowing more people to come back in?
Yeah, I think, let's be absolutely clear. The people who are coming back in are New Zealand residents and citizens, so they're people who have a right to come back here, and we can't stop them if they wish to come back. And we now have, I think we've doubled the number of people crossing the border each day compared to even sort of 2 or 3 weeks ago. So there has been a significant increase. Some of them are repatriation flights that have been negotiated over a period of time between our government and other governments and various airlines. So a lot of the folks coming back in from India, for example, via Air India flights, that's been negotiated for some time. So look, we're trying to now manage that flow. We can accommodate about 4,500 people in our quarantine facilities. And bearing in mind that You know, every day there's people who come in, but equally there's every day there's people who have completed their 14-day quarantine period, who are being tested and who are being released. But the volume of those coming across the border is such now, we do need to more carefully manage that. Look, we're confident we do have the facilities to do it. We've got to make sure those facilities are managed well and properly, and that it's not posing any further risk. We always predicted that as more people came across the border, and as they were going into a quarantine, that we would pick up more people diagnosed with COVID-19, and that is happening. But everybody who is being diagnosed with it, every new case, is being picked up through the quarantining process, which is the right thing to do, and is not putting, you know, the community at risk. The main thing is to avoid community transmission, and at the moment we are doing that, and we're pretty confident that we will keep community transmission at bay.
Speaking of community transmission, now, because more people are voluntary testing for COVID-19, which is a good thing, but some, as Stuff reported yesterday, some of the traffic jams for testing, someone needs to wait up to 2 hours just to get a test. Do you think we should have more testing points instead of putting them in specific places like malls, maybe even allow GPs to do the testing themselves?
Yeah, look, I think what happened, we were doing a lot of testing, you know, like 3 or 4 weeks ago, as the number of active cases fell, and the number of, in fact, we had 2 weeks or more of zero cases, then a lot of the community testing facilities were sort of wound up and packed up. Now we're in the process of putting some of those back, and also allowing GPs, obviously, to get to do testing as well. So that is starting to ramp back up again, I think, and partly because as we get deeper into winter, the colds and flus are starting to come back, and people want to be sure that it is just a cold or a flu, that it's not COVID-19. So you will see more testing facilities in what they call the community-based assessment centres. Some of them that were in operation a month or so ago will be reinstated so that we can get through a bigger volume of testing.
Moving on to an issue that happened over in Australia last week. Now Canberra has said there has been a major cyber attack on Australian businesses and different levels of government. Considering we have an election in mind, what is the current risk of New Zealand having a cyber attack?
Well, there's always a risk. I mean, cyber attacks are happening all the time. We have a low incidence of cyber attacks in New Zealand, and there could be anything from, you know, attacking a network to bring it down, to, you know, phishing scams, to ransomware attacks, and we've had some of those have hit the headlines just in recent weeks. So we are, you know, we're as susceptible as anybody to it. I think what Australia was pointing out is that there had been a major escalation in the incidence of those cyber attacks for them. We haven't seen that here. But as I say, it remains a risk. In terms of the election, the Electoral Commission is working, you know, closely with their experts and indeed our security and intelligence agencies to make sure that their database of registered voters is protected, and that their systems, their online systems, are protected as well. So I'm confident that we are doing everything we can to protect our networks, to protect our data, and so that our election and the integrity of it is protected as well.
And moving on to the sexual offences bill that you have put in Parliament. Now, there are a couple of issues raised by New Zealand First and some defence lawyers over the issue of fair trials. And in fact, New Zealand First Minister Tracy Martin told our colleague Lillian Hanley yesterday that there are systematic failures, such as police pushing cases without sufficient evidence, that led to a low number of successful rape prosecutions and allegations going to court. And what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I hadn't heard issues about lack of evidence by the police. What I know from surveys and what have you is that a lot of victims of sexual violence don't even report to the police because they find even having to do that too traumatic. Many are frightened off doing so because of the experiences of others have gone through the court system. We know that those charges that do go to court, it's, you know, one of the lowest conviction rates of any class of offending is sexual violence offending. We know from the experiences of a lot of those who do give evidence that it is traumatic. This was looked at by the Law Commission, and they formulated a bunch of recommendations, which is the basis of the sexual violence legislation bill, to try to remove the more traumatic aspects of the court process for victims of sexual violence. The complaints by the lawyers are, first of all, that doing pre-trial cross-examination, so the victim gets to give their evidence on video and be cross-examined on video, means that they might have to show their hand or disclose their defence early. That doesn't need to be the case. If that video evidence is done a week or so before the regular trial, they don't lose anything as a result. Their second objection is that there would be limits on cross-examining on the sexual history between the victim and the defendant. Now, the role of the Crown is to prove that the particular incident that constitutes the sexual violence happened, and that it wasn't consensual. Consent given on previous occasions doesn't mean that consent is given for subsequent occasions. Actually, the defence loses nothing by applying that principle. They're claiming that it does. I certainly disagree with that. But look, New Zealand First is taking time to examine it more closely. I know that they're talking to others and talking to Crown prosecutors and others. So it's fine for them to do that. So we'll see where we get on that.
Do you think the bill itself offered the balance between the victim and the right to be proven guilty? Because certainly those defence lawyers and New Zealand First think it it floats too heavily on the victim for this, for these proposals.
Yeah, look, just on one point there. Look, in fairness to New Zealand First, they haven't taken a position on whether they agree with the defence lawyers and the comments they're making. They heard what they've said and said, okay, well, we want to have a look into this. And I think, to be fair to New Zealand First, an issue has been raised with them. They haven't formed a view on it. They want to get more information on it. In terms of the defence lawyers and what they're saying, I think they are being alarmist. And look, there's a bit of patch protection going on here. They want to preserve the situation that they've got, but the reality is far too many victims of sexual violence going through the process from complaining to the police to being prepared for trial and going to trial are being traumatised as a result, and that is not right. There is another problem with the law that we have, and that is that the lower level sexual offending ends up, you know, results in quite serious charges being laid with very serious penalties, you know, starting at 14 years prison for that. And so it forces defendants, regardless of the level of offending, to put on the maximum kind of defence. Whereas there is a level of sexual offending where even victims are saying, look, I don't want the guy to go to prison. I just want him to acknowledge what he's done to me and the harm he's caused, and I want to find a different way through this. The criminal justice system doesn't allow that and accommodate that, and we do have to find a way to allow that to happen, and that'll be the next tranche of work that we do. But in the meantime, those who are facing, defendants who are facing trial, shouldn't be allowed then to further traumatise the victim, and we're just trying to find the balance that allows fair trial rights to be respected and observed, but victims not to be further traumatised.
But are you confident that you can bring New Zealand First on board and get this bill passed before the election?
Look, I can't guarantee it's going to be passed before the election. I think New Zealand First are doing the responsible thing. They've had issues raised with them that's caused them to be concerned. They're going out getting additional information and talking to other people, independent of those who have talked to them so far. I think that is the right thing to do. But how long that takes them and where we get to is difficult to tell. So I can't say whether or not it'll be passed before the election.
And my final question for today is, you now have three bills being stored by New Zealand First, including the rape trials legislation, the hate speech legislation and rent relief legislation. And with Labour's main flagship policies from this capital gains tax to as recent as yesterday, the Auckland Light Rail being stalled because of difference with its collision partners as well. Are you willing to work with New Zealand First again after the election if you have to form a government with them?
Look, if the circumstances were such that we were in a position to form a government, obviously we'd look very closely at New Zealand First. We'd have to. Apart from the last few weeks, we've actually worked very well and very closely with New Zealand First. The reality is we are in the sort of twilight zone before the next general election. Parties like New Zealand First and, for that matter, the Greens, are busily trying to clearly distinguish and delineate themselves from us and any other party in Parliament. And this is what this looks like. You know, that's why the Green Party put up their amendment proposal on the prisoner voting bill last night. They wanted to be clear that this is what we stand for. They didn't expect it to pass, and then the National Party voted for part of it. And so these things happen, and likewise New Zealand First wants to be very clear about what they stand for, which they see they can do by, you know, stopping various other proposals in their tracks. Look, that's their judgment. We're 3 months out from the election. We expect it would get a bit like this. But actually, when you look back in the last 2.5 years, these are three parties that have formed a very stable and very good government.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little. The Wire. Kei te whakarongo.